This is day four of the 2012 Rogue River Bible School. The speaker is Brother Jim Cowie. His subject is the prophecy of Zephaniah. The title for today's class is, I Will Turn to the Peoples of Pure Language. Brother Jim.
Well, thank you, Brother Paul. Brothers and sisters, today is the day when all of the work that we have done on the background of Zephaniah bears its fruit. We're going to see today how all of this culminates in Zephaniah chapter 3, verses 8 to 10 in particular. But I'm going to actually start with verses 1 to 7. You can see those areas highlighted there on the screen. We want to have a look briefly at the content of Zephaniah 3, 1 to 7. And then we're going to have a look at verses 8, 9 and 10. And God willing, tomorrow we'll conclude by the final section of Zephaniah, which is about this remnant being restored and redeemed. So we've learned in our studies thus far, brothers and sisters, that as judgment bore down upon God's people, he expanded that to include his ultimate purpose in reversing the work of Nimrod. So having dealt with the city of Nineveh in the land of Assyria, founded by Nimrod, and demonstrated that their doom was impending, why would not Yahweh return to talk about his own city, Jerusalem, which had modelled itself on Babylon and Nineveh because of Manasseh's taking of all that belonged to Babylon and bringing it into Jerusalem? Now Yahweh turns to that city. That's the subject matter of Zephaniah 3 verse 1. Having looked at Nineveh, he now looks at his own city, Jerusalem, and he says this about it: woe to her that is filthy and polluted, to the oppressing city. They had adopted the idolatry of Nimrod. It was still there, even though, of course, Josiah was to remove most of it. It was there when Zephaniah was prophesying. His reformation had not yet come. It happened in Josiah's when he was 20 years of age, in the 12th year of his reign. So it was there, it was evident. And so Yahweh looks now at his own city. And he calls it a filthy city because of that idolatry, and he calls it an oppressing city because, of course, the attitude of his people was that of Nimrod. Destroy your enemies. Pursue your enemies. And that's what was happening. And we're going to see who the pursuers were in a moment. So he says in verse 2, she obeyed not the voice. She received not correction. She trusted not in Yahweh. She drew not near to her God. There are four elements that are absolutely essential to salvation there, brothers and sisters. There was no hearkening to the word. And it's the word of God that is our motivation. Paul said in Philippians 2 verse 13, for it is God that worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. There was no acceptance of correction. He hewed them by the prophets, we are told in Hosea. But it had no effect. It did no good for them. There was not an acceptance of correction. There was no humility amongst God's people. They did not trust in Yahweh. They did not depend upon him because they had sworn both to Yahweh and to Milcom, to Molech. And therefore, there was no drawing near to God. No personal relationships except for the small band that surrounded Josiah, whom Yahweh hid in the day of his anger. No relationship with God. Now there, brothers and sisters, is an equation that you and I need to apply to ourselves. We are facing divine judgment. It is bearing down upon the society in which we live. And we need to make sure that we've got these things, that we hearken to the word, that we accept correction, that we trust in our God, and that we build an effective relationship with him. It's pretty simple, isn't it? Well, he sweeps on to show that there were four leadership culprits to whom could be sheeted home the blame for what was happening in that day. Look at them in verse 3 and 4. Her princes within her are roaring lions. Her judges are evening wolves. They gnaw not the bones till the morrow. They don't leave anything for the morning. There's no breakfast because they consume it all in one day. That's how savage they were. So this was like Nimrod, wasn't it? That's the attitude of Nimrod. Her prophets are light and treacherous persons. Her priests have polluted the sanctuary. They have done violence to the law. They were supposed to uphold God's law. So the culprits here were the princes, the judges, the prophets, and the priests, namely the leadership of God's ecclesia in those days. Little wonder it was in the state that it was. He goes on to say in verse 5 that there would be four responses from Yahweh himself. Verse 5, the just or righteous Yahweh is in the midst thereof. And this begins a theme which is going to go right through this final chapter of the prophecy. This idea of Yahweh being in the midst of his people. I want you just to pick that one up and we'll focus upon it tomorrow, God willing. Yahweh is in the midst thereof. He will not do iniquity. Every morning doth he bring his judgment to light. He faileth not, but the unjust knoweth no shame. And because of what was happening, God was going to have to hide himself from his people and withdraw himself from the city where he had placed his name. That was the tragedy of it, brothers and sisters. So there are four remedies in verse 6 when you read that verse. I have cut off the nations, their towers are desolate. And we see that that language is pregnant with the idea that come from Nimrod's building of the Tower of Babel and from his city building. I made their streets waste, that none passeth by their cities, which are destroyed, so that there is no man, no Ish, no mighty man like Nimrod, that there is none inhabitant. So God's answer, his remedy, eradicate Nimrod in all of his forms. But then sadly we read verse 7. I said, surely thou wilt fear me, you will reverence me, thou wilt receive instruction, you will hearken to my word, so that their dwelling should not be cut off. I won't have to empty Jerusalem and its land, howsoever I punished them. But they rose early and corrupted all their doings. It was too deeply instilled in them, brothers and sisters. And that's why God said to Josiah, nothing you can do here. They've got to go to Babylon to have Nimrod removed from them. That idolatry will only be removed when I take them to the source of it. And they see it face to face in all its ugliness and its vileness, then they will repudiate it. And of course, 50,000 of them did. Now that's the sad story. But it brings us to perhaps what is the most important verse in the prophecy of Zephaniah. It's verse 8. Now let's just have a summary of what is in these next three verses of Zephaniah 3. This is the core, the kernel of this subject. This is where all our background work comes into focus. The theme here is that Israel's God is going to rise to the prey to reverse Nimrod's rebellion and the effects of that rebellion. That's the theme. So in verse 8 we have the nations assembled for Armageddon and subsequent judgments. In verse 9 we have the nations given a pure religion. And that's what the pure lip of verse 9 is all about, a pure religion. Because that's effectively what happened. Nimrod confused just the tongues. That wasn't the only result of his rebellion. He confused man's religion. When they came out of the ark, they had one lip, it says. They were all Christadelphians. They all had the same faith. They had one lip. What lip was that? Well, it was Hebrew. It was God's lip. It was God's religion. Can God talk anything other than right religion? Of course not. But by 100 years after the events of the flood, that pure religion, that pure lip, was gone. And now we have a multiplicity of religions in the world, don't we? To whom can you blame? Sheet home the blame? Well, to Nimrod. He was the one that brought that all about. There's not a religion upon the face of the earth that can't be traced back to Nimrod. Not one. In all of their vagaries and varieties, they all come back to him. And those of you who have read Alexander Hislop's The Two Babylons will understand that to some degree. In verse 10, we have scattered Israel recovered from dispersion. And we're going to see that that's also based upon the life of Abraham. So everything we've done now is going to come into focus. But first of all, let's put this chart up so that we can see the content of what follows here from verse 8 to the end of Zephaniah 3. We have on the one hand Nimrod, on the other hand, Yahweh. These are the two antagonists. When you bring that to the latter days, we have the papacy, that is the inheritor of all that Nimrod established, sitting in the temple of God, saying that he is God, a God king on earth. And you have our Lord Jesus Christ, the representative of Yahweh, who's going to establish the kingdom of God on the earth on the ruins of the kingdom of men, the kingdom of Nimrod. Got it? Look at the way it's presented, brothers and sisters. We know from Genesis 10, verses 8 and 9, that Nimrod was a mighty hunter. The word mighty, gibor, in the Hebrew. That word is used in Zephaniah 3:17. It says this: Yahweh thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. He's a gibor. That's the Hebrew word. He will save, etc. We'll come to that tomorrow. We read in Genesis 10, verse 10, that Nimrod established a kingdom, the first king of the kingdom of men. We'll look at verse 15 of Zephaniah 3. Yahweh hath taken away thy judgments. He hath cast out thine enemy. The king of Israel, even Yahweh, is in the midst of thee. You getting the idea of midst here? In Genesis 10, verse 9, we read that Nimrod was a hunter. What about God? Verse 8 of Zephaniah 3. Therefore wait ye upon me, saith Yahweh, until the day that I rise up to the prey. Here's the ultimate hunter. We read in Genesis 11 verse 4 that they set out to build the tower to make for themselves a name or a shem. Have a look at Zephaniah 3 verse 12. I will also leave in the midst of thee an afflicted and poor people, and they shall trust in the name, Hebrew, Shem, of Yahweh. Have a look at verse 19. Towards the end of the verse, I will get them, returning Israel, praise and fame. That word fame, Shem. I'll get them a name in every land where they have been put to shame. Have a look at verse 20. At that time will I bring you again, even in the time that I gather you, for I will make you a name and a praise among all peoples of the earth. So three times the word Shem is used in relation to God establishing in purity his name, ensconced in this case in redeemed Israel. Incredible, isn't it? There's a pattern here. And the language, of course, is critical to all of that. In Genesis 11 verse 9, the effect of Nimrod's work is that their tongue, their lip, their shofar was confused. Confused religion. When men speak, they speak from the heart. They had their religion confused. And in Zephaniah 3 verse 9 we read, for then will I turn or return or turn back to the peoples a pure shofar, a pure lip. And he means religion, as we'll see when we get to that verse in due course this morning. So there is the framework in which we're going to find this wonderful little prophecy of Zephaniah is brought to its finale. And it's a wonderful finale. But as I said, perhaps the most significant verse in the whole of this prophecy is chapter 3, verse 8. And it reads this way. I'm going to read to you in the AV, and then I'm going to read to you what's on the screen. Therefore wait ye upon me, saith Yahweh, until the day that I rise up to the prey. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms. Could I ask you, brothers and sisters, what Nimrod effected? He effected the scattering of the nations. He effected the dispersal of peoples, didn't he? That was the end result of his work. Well, Yahweh says, you wait till I rise up to the prey. And I'm going to assemble the kingdoms and gather them together. What for? We'll read on. That I may pour upon them mine indignation. Indignation? You know, Yahweh sits in the heavens and he's been doing this for 5 millennia, brothers and sisters. He has an indignation against what Nimrod did. Because millions, if not billions of people will not be in his kingdom because of what that man did. Does that make God indignant? Certainly. He sat there in that indignation, waiting. He's working. Oh, he's not just sitting there twiddling his thumbs. He's working. But he'd love to save the whole race if he could. But he can't. And even when Armageddon occurs, he won't be able to save those who continue to support Nimrod's successor. That's a tragedy. No wonder he has indignation. All my fierce anger, he says, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my what? Jealousy. Yes, God's jealousy. He's jealous. because Nimrod has taken away from him his people and confused their religion so they don't know him. They're completely blind. That's why he's indignant and that's why he's jealous. See how important this verse is in the scheme of things? So he's going to assemble them. He's going to reverse Nimrod's word. And he's going to do this. Young's literal says, "For then do I turn unto peoples," plural, "a pure lip, safar. Why? To call all of them by the name of Yahweh." Now we're going to see that that's actually based on Abraham. When he came out of the land of Assyria, having left the land of Babylon, and he became a Hebrew and crossed over, the very first place that he came to in the land, recorded for us in Genesis 12 verse 6, was what? Shechem, wasn't it? He came to Shechem. And then he went, after making sacrifice and having received the second promise, he went to where? To a place between Bethel and Hai. Bethel means the house of God, and that was to the west. And Hai means ruin, and that was the east, on the way back to Ur of the Chaldees. What did he choose? He chose the house of God. And then the record says he built an altar, he made sacrifice to his God to dedicate himself once more to his God, and he called, Genesis 12 verse 8, he called upon the name of Yahweh. What does that mean, brothers and sisters? It means that Abraham was confirmed in the religion that you and I have also adopted, being Abraham's spiritual children. And we all call upon the name of Yahweh. Now all of that is going to come back as we consider verses 9 and 10 of Zephaniah chapter 3. But let's focus for the time being on verse 8. It is one of the most significant sentences in the Bible. This verse contains every letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and there are 22 of them, including the 5 final letters of the Hebrew alphabet. So 27 in all. These 27 letters of the alphabet are used at least once in the verse, and that verse is just one sentence. Okay? Now, you can try this. Give me a sentence that contains every letter of the English alphabet, and I'll beat you to it. The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog. Who cares? Now, that's a sensible sentence, isn't it? What does it mean? Virtually nothing. But it's got every letter of the English alphabet in it. Well, this one, this sentence, has got every letter of the Hebrew alphabet in it, including the 5 finals. Now, that's remarkable. It doesn't happen very often, does it? Why? Why do you think that that's the way that the Spirit has recorded this through Zephaniah? Well, this is the most important mission of our God, brothers and sisters. This is why we've got the apocalypse. This is why we've got the whole Bible. Because God is determined to reverse the work of Nimrod. He's going to put him out of business forever and a day. And he's working in you and me to do that right now. And we can consider ourselves very, very privileged people that we've been brought into the family of Abraham for this purpose. That's why this sentence is there. 27 is 3 times 9. You put that in the scriptural way, 9, 9, 9. If you turn those upside down, what do you get? 6, 6, 6. Reckon that's an accident? Don't think so. This is the way our God works. 27 to a Hebrew. It includes, of course, 10 and 17. Now, 17 is the number that the Hebrews use for absolute completeness. Because 10 stands for all. We have 10 fingers, 10 toes, at least I have. Okay? There were 10 commandments, there were 10 phrases to the Lord's Prayer. You can go on forever and a day. 10 stands for all. And 17 is 10 plus 7. We know that 7 is a complete number. Okay? 17 is the 7th prime number. So there's a curiosity about the way that this is presented. There's an absolute, total fullness and finality. Got it? Have I stressed that enough? You see how important Zephaniah 3 verse 8 is to the scheme of things? So how does God go about this? Well, he went about it by selecting one man who used to worship at the ziggurat of Ur, which was after the same pattern as the Tower of Babel, just a smaller version. That's all. You can go there today in Iraq and visit the ziggurat at which Abram and Sarai, along with their family, worshipped the false gods of Nimrod. So what does God do? Plucks one man out of that place and says, I'm going to start with you. Now, did he have anyone that he could have called upon to do this work? Yes, Melchizedek, you remember. Melchizedek was already installed in Salem. So God could have worked through him, couldn't he? He didn't. He plucks one man out of the very heart of Nimrodian apostasy that he might begin a 5-millennium process to unwind the work of Nimrod. It's an incredible story. Your fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood, said Joshua, Joshua 24 verse 2, and they served other gods. Did you serve other gods if you came from outside? Even if you came like me from inside, did you serve other gods before God called you to the truth, brothers and sisters? See, he's done the same for many of us that he did for Abraham. And we are Abraham's children by faith, are we not? So God's purpose with Abraham is very important to us. Isaiah 51 verse 2, he said this, look unto Abraham your father, unto Sarah that bare you, for I called him alone and blessed him and increased him. What did that culminate in? Well, Genesis 22 verse 18, he promised him in his final words, in the seventh promise made to Abraham, and in thy seed, he means of course Christ, we know that from Galatians 3:16, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Starts with one man, gets a multitudinous seed. He does the same of course with Israel, as you'll see in a moment. So when God called Abraham from Ur of the Chaldees, he went to Haran. The reason that Terah chose Haran, because it was the second most important capital of the worship that was conducted in Ur of the Chaldees. They used to worship the moon god Nana, also known as Sin, S-I-N. Okay? The second most important place of the worship of Nana was Haran. That's why Terah went there, see? Takes a while, doesn't it, to leave behind the old way of life? And God then calls Abram a second time, using the same words that he spoke to him in Ur of the Chaldees, to get him out of Haran, to make him a Hebrew, a crosser over, that he might come into the land. And he comes into the land, and he comes to Shechem. Shechem means shoulder. You're going to meet that word in Zephaniah 3 and verse 9. Shechem means shoulder. It means to bear responsibility. He has the idea of government as well because of that. Okay? So this whole story is based upon what God did in the life of Abraham to extract him from the Nimrodian apostasy in which he was ensconced. Get thee out of thy country, he said to him. And so he does. And Abraham came from beyond the rivers of Cush. He's the original Cush, okay? He stayed on the other side of the Euphrates. Haran, by the way, brothers and sisters, is about 40 miles from the Euphrates. I was a little bit surprised at that. I would have thought that if you're going to stop somewhere, you'd stop where there's water. You know, a river running by. No, no, no. They went 40 or 50 miles north of the river Euphrates, because that just happens to be another centre of the worship of Nana, the moon god. Okay? So when God calls Abraham from Ur and then from Haran, he is brought from beyond the rivers of Cush. Now God's purpose with Israel, of course, is patterned upon what he did with Abraham. He says of Israel through Amos in chapter 3 verse 2, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. He said through the parables of Balaam, the people, meaning Israel, shall dwell alone and shall not be reckoned among the nations. They stand alone, brothers and sisters. But what is God's ultimate purpose? Well, it was expressed by the angel Gabriel to Mary, the mother of our Lord. And he shall reign over the house of Jacob. Notice that. Jacob forever. And of his kingdom there shall be no end. Now what does that actually mean, that phrase? Does that mean that Christ's kingdom will have no end in terms of time? No, it doesn't mean that, brothers and sisters. Because we are told in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and at verse 24 that then cometh the end, when he will have delivered up his kingdom to the Father. Got it? So Christ's kingdom lasts for 1,000 years. We know that from Revelation 20 verse 4 and verse 6, that the saints shall live immortally and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. But that is the length of his kingdom. God's kingdom, of course, will have no end, but Christ's kingdom will. So it doesn't mean time. It means territory. Proof. Proof is this. If you go to Isaiah 9, verses 6 and 7, where it speaks about unto us a son is given, etc., okay, and the government, you know what the word is in the Hebrew? Shechem. And the Shechem, the government shall be upon his shoulder. The word shoulder is Shechem. The government shall be upon his Shechem. Goes on to say this in verse 7. And of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. Now, how do you increase government? Well, if you're an American president, you just keep raising taxes. You know, you just keep putting in new rules and regulations. We live in a world of rules and regulations. You think your country's bad. You want to come to Australia. We've adopted the European model. Everything's regulated. You can't even drink a cup of tea without it being regulated by the government. So how do you increase government? You just keep extending control over people and over territory. How do you increase peace? Well, by bringing nations one after the other under your control and imposing peace on them. So when the promise was made to Mary, and of his kingdom there shall be no end, it was a promise that when that kingdom was fully established, it would cover the whole earth. It would begin with Jacob, with Israel, but it would be extended over 40 years around the whole world. And it won't matter where you go in the kingdom age, you'll be in the kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ. Of his kingdom there will be no end. Now, you think this is scriptural? Well, it's the 1270 principle, brothers and sisters, that we considered earlier in our studies. 12, the number of Israel. 70, the number of the nations. And we have passages like this, and you can multiply these. Psalm 59:13. Consume them in wrath. Consume them. This is about Armageddon. That they may not be. And let them know that God ruleth in Jacob unto the ends of the earth. Got it? The 1270 principle. So God begins with Israel, but he extends it to incorporate the Gentiles. Now that is what he's done with you and me. He starts with one man, and it's spread out from the family of Abraham, from Israel, to the nations. And we're all being incorporated into that one vast family. So when Abraham came from this place, from beyond the rivers of Cush, the original Cush of Genesis chapter 2, he was prefiguring the work that now follows in the rest of Zephaniah 3, the work of Elijah, which will be, of course, our subject for tomorrow. The 40-year mission of Elijah to recover the remnant of Israel in the second exodus of Israel that will take that 40-year period to accomplish. He will bring them into the wilderness of the peoples. There's only one wilderness of the peoples, and that's here in Europe. It is the home of the beast and the woman who sits astride the beast. Babylon the Great in biblical terms. And Israel will be brought here, and they will have to fight their way through this wilderness of the peoples over a bitter period of the hour of divine judgment of Revelation chapter 14 and verse 7. Until finally the rebels have been purged out and they are brought back to the land, baptized in the Euphrates and the Red Sea, and brought into the bonds of the covenant. That's, of course, the subject of Ezekiel chapter 20. That's what follows in the prophecy of Zephaniah. And we're going to conclude our studies tomorrow, God willing, in that area. But I want to come back now to Abraham. I want to focus upon what God did with Abraham. Now here's the first promise, and you might want to turn this up, Genesis chapter 12, just so that you can check me. Okay? Just check me. We read of the first promise made to Abraham that there were three conditions attached to it. Now Yahweh had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land, or the land as it should read, unto the land that I will show thee. Well, he wasn't shown the land immediately. Of course, we know from Hebrews 11 that they went forth from Ur of the Chaldees not knowing where they were going. But ultimately, of course, God draws him across the Euphrates and shows him the land. Now, well, three conditions had to be met before Abraham could receive the promise of the land. Now, those three conditions were, get thee out of thy country, he did that when he left Ur. From thy kindred, he did that when he left Haran. But what about thy father's house? Well, that didn't happen until Genesis 13 and verse 14. Genesis 13:14 says this, and Yahweh said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, so there is the third condition, from thy father's house, this is what God said to him, lift up your eyes and look in every point of the compass, for all the land that you see, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed after thee. It's the first time God promises Abram the land. First time. All you, the land's been promised to Christ before this. You have a look at Genesis 12 and verse 7. And Yahweh appeared unto Abram here in Shechem and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. Thy seed? Yes, Christ. So the land is promised to Christ before it's promised to Abraham. Very appropriately, brothers and sisters. You know, there's a simple lesson in all that. The Abrahamic promises have conditions attached to them. Don't they? They have conditions attached to them. And if we want to possess the land, we have to meet, like Abraham, those conditions. And we won't talk about what those conditions might be in our case. You can work that out. Okay, so we've got the way that this promise opens. But then comes the promise. It has seven clauses. And you can check these out, number them. The word and is very helpful. Verse 2. And I will make thee a great nation. And. So here's the second. I will bless thee. And so on it goes, as you can see on the screen. There are seven clauses to the promise. Now, this promise begins with the final denouement. The final divine objective, the reason why God calls Abram from Ur of the Chaldees. It is this simple phrase, brothers and sisters, and I will make of thee a great nation. He did not mean Israel in the days of David or Solomon or at any other time in its past history. He meant Israel at the end of the millennium when God will be all and in all. I'll demonstrate that to you because it is demonstrable from the scriptures. Okay? What does he mean by a great nation? Well, let's just go back and consider the use of this term nation, first of all. Nation or nations, goy or goyim, the plural, means a nation or a people. Noun, masculine in the Hebrew. It first occurs in Genesis 10 verse 5 of the Gentiles and nations. The next four occurrences are rendered nations in Genesis 10, 20, 31 and 32, twice. The seventh occurrence is in Genesis 12, verse 2. I will make of thee a great nation. So that the seventh time that God uses the Hebrew tongue to express this word goy or goyim just happens to be in the first of seven promises made to Abraham, which just happens to have seven clauses to it. You think there might be something happening here? Well, hold on. There is something happening here. This is the first of seven clauses, as I said, of seven promises made to Abraham. Now, this word great that you can see highlighted in yellow, that word great is the Hebrew word gadol. It's also the seventh occurrence of that word in the Old Testament. What about the word families? In thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Well, it's this word mishpachah. It means a clan, a family, a tribe, etc. People or nation. Its first occurrence is in Genesis 8 verse 19, rendered in the AV, kinds. The next five occurrences are rendered families, Genesis 10:5, 18, 20, 31, and 32. Do I need to remind you that Genesis 10 is the chapter about the division of the nations, the work of Nimrod? No. The seventh occurrence of this word families is in Genesis 12, verse 3. In thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. Seven clauses in the first of seven promises. Seven, the number of the Abrahamic covenant. And this word blessed in verse 3? Well, blessed is the word barak in the Hebrew. The seventh occurrence of this word barak is in Genesis 12 verse 2. I will bless thee. The tenth occurrence of the word barak in the Old Testament is this word here in verse 3. And 10 stands for all, as I said. In thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. What do you reckon about that? Are we reading an inspired book, brothers and sisters? Well, if the God who inspired Abram to leave behind Nimrodian idolatry can do that in the life of that man and record it like that, he can do it for you and me, can't he? Abraham's spiritual children. Now, where does this all culminate? Well, it culminates at the end of our Bibles. You might want to come to the other end of the Bible, to Revelation. I did tell you that Zephaniah is a giant stepping stone between Genesis and Revelation. Revelation, last three chapters. The last three chapters of our Bible, and of course we know that the chapters were put in 1450-odd, so they're not God's work, but there are three subjects at the end of the book that we call the Bible. And they're Revelation 20, 21 and 22. They're all about the culmination of the three great covenants of our Bible. Revelation 20 is about the final fulfillment of Genesis 3:15. The old serpent, the one that was back in the garden, why he's described as an old serpent, is bound and finally destroyed. Which means, of course, that you have to destroy the two great enemies of our God, sin and death. So sin and rebellion are eradicated and death is abolished in Revelation chapter 20. Genesis 15 is fulfilled. In Revelation 21 we have the Abrahamic covenant fulfilled. And we'll talk more about this in a moment. It speaks of the holy city. It's an Abrahamic city, as we're going to see. It's completed beyond the millennium. There's one nation left on earth, the nation of Israel, that embraces all people. And there's an eternal inheritance experienced by all. That's what God promised to Abraham, wasn't it? Eternal inheritance. In Revelation 22, we have the promises to David fulfilled. There's divine authority over all the earth. David's throne is established forever. The spiritual house of David is seen to be complete. So his promises will be fulfilled. How do we know that? Well, Revelation 22 begins with a throne. I saw a throne, he says. What throne? Well, it's the one of chapter 4 of Revelation. It's the throne of David. How do we know that, brother? Well, because in verse 16 he says, I am the root and the offspring of David. Got it? Revelation 22 is all about the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant. So the three great covenants of our Bible are seen to be accomplished in the last three chapters of the Bible. Wonderful design, brothers and sisters. Just beautiful the way our God has couched this in his word. And you don't need to be Einstein to see that, do you? That, you know, when you think about it, that is pretty plain what he's portraying there. So what's the purpose of the millennium? Well, it's to bind the old serpent. So you have a jubilee period at the beginning and a jubilee period most likely at the end. So here we've got the period of divine judgment. It begins with the resurrection of the dead, the judgment of the saints, their glorification, and then 40 years of conflict to establish the kingdom. Then flesh, the old serpent, shall be bound for 1,000 years. But then he's released, he's unleashed. And there's a great rebellion against the rule of Christ and the saints at the end of the millennium. But then there's a second resurrection and judgment following the eradication of that rebellion. And in flesh, carnality, the old serpent will be bound and eradicated forever. And hence the earth can rest from war. I will put hostility between the serpent and the woman. And that battle will go on until the serpent power is utterly eradicated. So who would be the political manifestation of that in the history of mankind, do you think? Nimrod. He's got to go, brothers and sisters. He's got to go. And when he goes, what he accomplished, the division of the nations, will all be over. Because there will only be one nation left upon the earth. In fulfillment of this prophecy, twice repeated in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 30 verse 11, 46, 28. Though I make a full end of all nations, whither I have scattered thee, O Israel, yet will I not make a full end of thee. So I'm going to get rid of all the nations. And it's a full end. That means abolition. But not of Israel. Oh yes, I'll punish you in measure. And he's been doing that. But not of Israel. That will remain forever. That one nation upon earth. As I said the other day, this is all prefigured in what happened in the Feast of Tabernacles. And that's why the nations will keep the Feast of Tabernacles in the millennial age. They will come up from year to year to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Why? Because God is teaching them that he's going to abolish their nation and incorporate them into one, the nation of Israel. Which is why on the eighth day, which speaks of the eighth millennium, they offered just one bullock after having offered 70 over the course of 7 days or seven millennia, so to speak. Got the idea? Okay. Revelation 21. You there? Revelation 21. It speaks of the time beyond the millennium. I guess many of you have notes on this. And in fact, in the package that we're going to give you, there's a whole set of Bible marking notes on the apocalypse. And you'll find that, this what I'm saying, in that set of notes. Now, the first eight verses of Revelation 21 are about the time beyond the millennium. Then from verse 9 to the end of the chapter, you get the way in which that's going to happen. You know, it's about the millennial period. But the first eight verses draw aside the curtain so that we can look into the future beyond the millennium. Into the third heaven, as Paul calls it in 2 Corinthians 12. So this is a wonderful vision. How does it start? Verse 1. And I saw a new heavens and a new earth, for the first, he means the former, and the former is the millennial heavens and earth. So the 1,000-year reign is over. That former heavens and earth, the new that we're looking for, is gone. And what we've got now is the third heaven, the perfect heaven and earth. How do we know that? Well, because of what it says in verse 1. For the first or former heaven and earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. What is the sea symbolic of in the scripture, and especially in the apocalypse? Chapter 17, verse 15 tells you, the sea upon which the woman sitteth are peoples and nations and tongues. Where did they come from? Peoples, nations and tongues, from the events of Genesis chapter 11 and the work of Nimrod. That's where they came from. No more peoples, nations and tongues. They're all gone. But there's one left. One nation. Let's read on. And I, John, saw, he says, I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. Is the final phase of the ecclesia. Now, how is this New Jerusalem identified? Well, it's got 12 stamped all over it. Look at verse 12, which is very appropriate. And had a wall great and high, and had 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and the names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. You can't miss that, can you? This one nation that is left is the nation of Israel. It's dominated by 12. And in fact, the number 12 occurs 12 times, if you want to just be a little bit sort of elastic and take the 144 cubits of verse 17 as 2 12s. I mean, it's 12 times 12, isn't it? The number 12 occurs 12 times. Come on. This is not accidental, brothers and sisters. This city is a corporation of immortal people. The Israel of God in its final manifestation. And here it is. This is the way it's symbolised. Now, of course, it's not a city. This is 2,400 kilometres or 1,500 or 1,600 miles in your language. Okay? Now, how can you have a cube-like city of 1,500 miles? Well, you can't, because it's not a literal city, of course. 12 is stamped all over it, and, of course, the 1,000 referred to represents to a Hebrew a family. So this is the perfected family. The whole family of Israel in its final form. It's a perfect cube because it is perfect. It's the most holy upon the earth. Everybody on earth will be immortal, and God will be all and in all. He'll have no diffidence to actually come amongst men. Look at Revelation 21 verse 3. It says this, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them." He will dwell with them? Yes. "And they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. Blessed are the pure in heart," said Christ, "for they shall see God." That can only happen when sin and death have been abolished. And God is all and in all. Brothers and sisters, Paul said in Ephesians 3:18-21, words like this, that we might be able to comprehend with all saints what is the breadth and length and depth and height, four things. Four, the number of God manifestation in the Bible, the framework of the encampment of Israel, the answer to Nimrod's four posted megacities. God has reversed everything that Nimrod did. "And to know the love of Christ which passeth knowledge, that ye might be filled with all the fullness of God." Won't that be a terrific day? So what kind of city is this? Well, it's Abrahamic. It just so happens that the word city occurs 12 times in Revelation 21 and 22. And it's an Abrahamic city. I want you to come to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11, we read this. In verse 10 of Abraham, "For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God." Verse 16. "God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city." So Abraham was looking for a city. You and I are looking for a city, but we don't mean by that a city full of towers, do we? No, a different kind of city, a corporation of people. How do we know? Turn the page, Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12, verses 22 and 23. "But ye are come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and ecclesia of firstborns, which are written in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirits or characters of just men made perfect." That's the city, brothers and sisters. It's an Abrahamic city. That's why we know that when we read about that vision in Revelation 21, it's the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise. Because what John sees is this Abrahamic city, the new Jerusalem coming from God. And it replaces the kingdom of men. It has removed everything for which Nimrod stood and which he created. The holy city is styled by Brother Thomas the New Jerusalem Body Politic and the Holy Jerusalem Association of Saints. He says in Eureka, Volume 1, it is the Yahweh Elohistic Municipality, symbolized by 144 cubits. Each cubit representing 1,000 of the numerical symbol of this holy nation, the Israel of the deity. So what we've been considering in the prophecy of Zephaniah, which culminates so wonderfully at the end of the millennium, is a tale of two cities. Enoch was the first city built by a man. It was built by Cain. Cain was the first Judaizer, brothers and sisters. And Roman Catholicism grew up in the ecclesia of the 2nd and 3rd centuries because of the Judaistic tendencies of its people. It was the commercialized religion that they brought back from Babylon that was to ultimately corrupt the foundations of the faith and produce the great apostasy from within the brotherhood that we now call the Roman Catholic Church, and which the Bible calls Babylon the Great. Cain was the first city builder. And when Nimrod set out to build his megacity in the plain of Shinar, he built Erech, which is the same in the language that he was using as the town Enoch. He rebuilt the city that Cain had established. And he built Babylon, with all that that means. But when it's finished, when God is not ashamed to be called or to be surnamed the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob, you and I and the whole world will be members of this city, the new Jerusalem. And the rebellion of Nimrod will be reversed. There'll be one language, one Sephar, Zephaniah 3 verse 9. One language. Just come back finally in the last minute or so. In fact, I want to over time just a fraction, but I don't think you'll mind. Just give me 1 minute. Zephaniah chapter 3. We read this in verse 9. For then will I turn to the peoples a pure Sephar. First use in the Bible, Genesis 11 verse 1. They were all of one lip, one language, one religion. That pure religion will be restored. All nations, the 70 that Nimrod brought about, will be incorporated into one, the nation of Israel. All families of the earth will be blessed in Abraham and his seed. One city, a great nation, a corporation of people remains in which all are immortal. The perfected bride of Christ in its fullness. And sin and death abolished from the earth. And God dwelling with men. And never again on earth will you ever hear these words, the name of Nimrod. We will rebel. That era will be gone forever.